Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. And that again, that's Sandy Nelson with Let There Be Drums. You know, drums, man. Drums is what gets everybody moving one way or another, no matter what time of the day it is. Those drums are going to lock around your heart, lock around your lungs, push your breath out, and get you moving. And that's what we're doing with the show today. That's why that thing is so important as the opening song of that show, because I love it, and I love what it does to me and to everybody else I know. All right? So keep listening. Sandy Nelson, Let There Be Drums. All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, if it's not already obvious, all right? And our show today is packed, so I'm just going to jump into a quick rundown of the lineup and then jump into our first guest or into this discussion with our first guest. I've jumped into him before, and it was scary. Okay, anyway, at the end of the show, we are going to be featuring Jeff Charlotte, journalist and author on his latest book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. Before that, we'll be talking with Jen Marlowe and Laura Moyer. Jen's a filmmaker, author, playwright, and human rights advocate. And Laura is the death penalty abolition campaign director for Amnesty International. We'll be talking about Troy Davis and the possibility that he may get an execution date very, very soon. But opening the show up, I'm really happy to welcome back to the show Larry Everest. He's a reporter for Revolution Newspaper, the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're talking with him about the situation in Libya and what's behind the fall of Gaddafi. His latest article, The Fall of the Gaddafi Regime in Libya and the Hand of the U.S. and NATO, is available on revcom.us. And Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
You too, man. Well, let's jump into this because, like I said, the show is packed, and I want to make sure that we have enough time to spend a good deal of time with each and every guest. So let's jump into this. This is a very important subject. It's one that's been rocking the news for months and months and months, and in particular over the last week or so, where supposedly what the U.S. is saying, and it looks like there's, you know, at least they've driven the Gaddafi regime out of Tripoli. They're talking about that this is a victory for rebel forces, and it's being presented by both the U.S. and the European imperialists as a tremendous victory for the people and for democracy. What's your take on that?
Well, those are lies. It does look like the Gaddafi regime's 42-year reign is coming to an end. The fighting hasn't stopped. Pro-Gaddafi forces are apparently still in control of certain areas, but they've been driven out of Tripoli. It looks like Gaddafi's reign is over. But this isn't a victory for the people. This is yes, there was an uprising beginning in Benghazi in mid-February, and there may have been many Libyans who wanted to overthrow this oppressor that Gaddafi was. But this was very quickly taken over and directed by the U.S. and reactionary forces in Libya, who are basically under the dominance and control of the U.S. and NATO. And essentially, this is a U.S.-NATO operation and victory aimed at strengthening their control over Libya. This has nothing to do with humanitarian concerns. This has nothing to do with ensuring self-determination for the people of Libya. This has nothing to do with liberating the people of Libya and bringing human liberation, which is greatly needed in Libya and across Africa and the Middle East.
Well, let's sort of parse this out a little bit, because when you talk about this, you know, it is always presented, and I can't tell you how many times I've looked at the newspaper and just my blood has boiled when they're showing all this stuff. And there's that positive aspect of you see people really wanting to rebel against oppression. But then you also see all the snake charmers and all the just really, you know, all kinds of characters in there, very unsavory characters who are leading this. And also you wonder, you look at that and they're talking about the heroic rebels and they do all this stuff. But right behind it, always hidden, always slightly hidden just behind the headlines, is the fact that the U.S. and NATO in particular and the Western Europeans have really, I mean, it hasn't just been a providing, you know, financial aid or you know, support, sort of, look, buck up, we're going to give you moral support or something. They've actually carried out quite a bit of the war themselves.
Well, that's correct. I mean, from the very beginning, they jumped in very quickly on the 26th of February, roughly 10 days after the uprising began. The UN Security Council imposed sanctions on Gaddafi. By March 17th, The UN had voted to authorize this no-fly zone, which actually became a justification for military attacks against all sorts of targets in Libya, including Gaddafi himself. This was a justification for a massive air assault by the West that included over 7,500 actual strikes on all sorts of different targets in Libya. The other thing that was going on was by mid-February, and Obama had authorized a secret finding for the CIA to go into Libya to provide arms and support for the Libyan rebels and to carry out covert actions. And it's been reported that, by mid-February, late February, there were both CIA operatives in Libya as well as dozens of British special forces, and Qatar has sent personnel. So there's a whole cabal of various foreign operatives and covert operators. And they also very quickly moved to strengthen the leadership of this uprising, or the forces within this uprising that are very much directed toward allying with imperialism.
Well, this is something I wanted to actually ask you about, because part of the thing is that, look, they've presented these rebels as romanticized Robin Hoods and all this other stuff, that people who are just and it really, it was almost like, they were just very celebratory. And there was a positive aspect of people really wanting to get out from under a very oppressive regime. At the same time, they have, I was thinking about this back months ago when one of their leaders was taken out. I think it might have been one of their military leaders was taken out. And they had an article on one side of the paper that said that there were these CIA forces operating inside Libya at the time, with the giving ground support to the rebels. And then they talked about how this guy was taken out, and they weren't sure who took him out, but it came from a sniper shot 200 yards away, at least, and you're thinking, and this guy turns out, this is the guy that they were talking about was linked with Al-Qaeda. And, there seemed to be, to me at the time, a certain amount of cleansing of this leadership and getting them ready to step in and operate in the interests of the U.S. Now, who exactly are these people in this Transitional National Council.
Your commander you're referring to is actually an interior minister for Gaddafi until very shortly before the uprising began. Jalil, the head of the Transnational Council, which is the force that the imperialists are anointing as the leadership of this. There are a lot of different rebel groups and groups of fighters and so on in the field. So this is a complex situation. But Jalil, the head of this, is a former justice minister for Gaddafi. Mahmoud Jabril, who is another cabinet, who's the head of the cabinet, actually led the Gaddafi regime's he's an economist, close ties with Qatar, who's been the lead Arab country supplying military and economic assistance to the rebel. He was the one of the designers of the Gaddafi regime's neoliberal economic reforms, which scored very high on the IMF report card. So that says quite a bit about that. Khalifa Haftar, one of the rebel military commanders, is a longtime CIA asset. You've got the son of the former King Idris in this council. And even today, on the front page of the Times, there's an article about the military chief of Tripoli is a former Islamic fundamentalist fighter in Afghanistan. So you've got a whole melange of reactionary and pro-imperialist forces that are basically in leadership of this. And as you're pointing out, the U.S. and NATO are doing everything they can to strengthen these forces.
And it doesn't seem like it's something. Well, let me remind people that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Larry Everest from Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the fall of the Gaddafi regime in Libya and the hands of the U.S. and NATO in it. Now, you know, one of the things, too, Larry, is with these people they're setting up and with the role of the U.S. And NATO in Libya, it certainly doesn't seem as though that they are saying, OK, once now we've gotten you in. And they did play a big role even all the way up to this point of, you know, sort of pounding Tripoli, for instance, before the rebels could go in and valiantly take over. And at the same as they put it, you know, and, you know, what you see is they are actually planning long range. They're planning out how to actually, you know, administer Libya and to do it in a sense of not helping them to create a liberated country, but actually figuring out the ways that Libya can be even more deeply entrenched in the imperial network worldwide. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, that's important. And, you know, your first point, I think that it really hasn't come out how directly the U.S. and NATO actually engineered and orchestrated the takeover of Libya, of Tripoli, rather, in this final offensive. I mean, the New York Times has reported about closer aerial and intelligence sharing and this being a major factor. But one think tank report I saw said that it was the insertion of NATO special operations troops, hundreds of them, who actually attacked and destabilized government forces. And it was after that that then the Western rebels entered the city and you had the great media fanfare about a people's rebellion. So there's a lot to be determined about this. But to get to your second point, yes, just yesterday, the U.S., France, Britain, Italy, and the TNC met in Paris to shape the future of Libya. And I think one thing that's important to understand, and Raymond Lotta does a very I link to his article, to his interview with Revolution, very important background, and I know you've talked about this with Raymond, very important background to this, and he makes the point that the Gaddafi regime and the Libyan military didn't have the kind of links with foreign imperialism that, say, a country like Egypt and its military did, and that the imperialists saw this as an opportunity to create a much more pliant neo-colonial regime in Libya. And at this meeting in Paris yesterday, you could see this unfolding because they're talking about sending UN experts there. And look, the UN is a body dominated by the great powers of the world, by imperialism. This isn't a body that represents the will and interests of world humanity. UN advisors will be reshaping the police force and helping set up the government and the legal structure. Their CIA operatives there coordinating with the military and seeking to control where the various weapons from the Gaddafi regime are. There have been different kinds of position papers already published as early as June about the shape of the future of Libya. And we've also got the battle over oil. We can't leave that out, Michael. The French and the British, which have not been as influential in the Libyan oil production as the Italian imperialists have, they're angling and fighting for greater access and control of this. So while oil isn't the only factor, it is certainly one factor in all this.
We're talking with Larry Everest from Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And we're talking with Larry about the fall of the Gaddafi regime in Libya and the imperialist hands behind it. Well, let me ask you one last question, Larry. We have about 3 minutes to get into it. The big, big question, I think, for a lot of people in the world is that, and the thing that's being really sharply debated out right now, is this whole idea that that NATO and the imperialists have all gone into this with the idea of a responsibility to protect the people in Libya, and what that means, what it comes down to, is they argue that this is a humanitarian mission that they've been on. And you speak to that pretty sharply in your article, and I'd like you to get into that, because I do think this is one very, very sharp debate that's going on and needs to go on, and people need to get clear on this. Humanitarian mission or outright murder?
Outright murder. Look, first, we don't know the toll, but here's some snapshots. One report in the New York Times talked about a deluge on August 26th, a deluge of casualties at Tripoli Central Hospital. Doctors are reporting they're treating as many as 500 patients a day. This, no doubt, is from the combination of bombing, the actions of the Qaddafi, the reactionary Qaddafi regime, which, yes, has massacred fighters and civilians and so on, although not at all to the degree that's being hyped up in the media. You've got the effect of NATO bombs. There's also a humanitarian dimension in that the war and the blockade cut off food, cut off fuel, cut off water, sanitations for over 70% of Tripoli's 1.7 million residents. That's over a million people that are still suffering this. And then on top of this, you've got these U.S. NATO-led forces just carrying out massacres, including there was a report in the Independent on August 27th, for example, of these rebels murdering suspected Qaddafi supporters who are lying on stretchers with intravenous drips. There have been roundups and in some cases murders of black migrant workers, and they make up perhaps a third of Libya's total population. So profound racism and reaction at work, where bombs are still falling, particularly on CERT. A bloodbath could be in the offing. They've surrounded the city with 10,000 fighters, as well as NATO operatives, and they're threatening a bloodbath if Qaddafi's forces don't surrender. And then let's look beyond what's going on immediately with these kinds of crimes. What about the future of Libya? The future of the Libya that the U.S. and NATO are going to bring is one where imperialism is strangling this country, exploiting its resources and its people, maintaining a dictatorship over the people. Look at what's happened in Iraq. Look at what's happened in particular. Has that brought liberation to the people? No, it's put a different set of more pro-U.S. reactionaries in power. And let's not forget, Michael, the Libyan intervention is also aimed at strengthening the U.S.'s grip over this whole region, the whole Middle East, North African region, and over Africa itself. And think about the untold suffering of literally tens and tens of millions of people that has gone on since the U.S. has dominated this whole region for the last 60 years since World War II.
All right, we're going to have to wrap up on that note, Larry, and unless you have something you can squeeze in 10 seconds.
Hey, this was great, Michael. Good to talk to you.
You too, man. So take care, and we'll have you back again soon.
The article, I think, is the best, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. People should go to revcom.us and check out Larry's article. And the article is on the fall of the Qaddafi regime in Libya and the hand of the U.S. and NATO involved in it. We've been talking with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper. I want to thank Larry for joining us today. And now we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we return, we'll be talking with filmmaker Jen Marlowe and Laura Moye from Amnesty International about the case of Troy Davis. So stay tuned.
For 20 hard years, he been wrongly accused. I'm talking about Troy Davis, let me bring you the news. I had a dirty DEA, broke all the rules. Spent a lot of fun the game to make sure you lose. If you pick up the paper and you check the news, they don't got mad at me, I ain't broke no rules. I'm just talking out loud about your backdoor paper. It's court documented, so these facts on paper. So let's get it straight, I ain't scared of y'all. My team to show the proof on the news at the hall. So now it's time to sit back and take that fall. I got a big mouth and I'ma tell it all. How you mapped out your artwork, your frame and all. You retire while you're still giving Chisholm a call. Got a question for you, you a man of mouth. You're getting mail from an eyewitness to your house.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. It's a great song, actually, and it's Free Troy Davis. And it's by E-Red, and the album is Truth Serum, The Conflict and the Resolution. Free Troy Davis. Joining us now to talk about the case of Troy Davis and what's going on with that and the fact that he is, in fact, facing the possibility of getting an execution date in the very near future. Joining us to talk about this is Jen Marlowe, filmmaker, author, playwright, and human rights advocate, and Laura Moyer, the Death Penalty Abolition Campaign Director from Amnesty International USA. Jen, Laura, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Michael.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. Well, let's start with Jen first. Jen, tell people, just for people who might not know, who is Troy Davis and why are we talking about him today?
Troy Davis is a man on death row in the state of Georgia, and he was convicted for the 1989 murder of a police officer in Savannah, Georgia. And Troy was convicted primarily based on eyewitness testimony. And out of the 9 eyewitnesses who testified that they saw Troy commit the murder, 7 out of the 9 of them have since recanted their testimony or contradicted their testimony, many of them citing police coercion and intimidation as the reason why they initially implicated Troy. So Troy is a man on death row in Georgia whose case has essentially fallen apart. The case against him has unraveled. Yet the state of Georgia is potentially going to set an execution date for him very soon, possibly as soon as next week. It possibly could be announced. And Troy's legal process is over. The U.S. Supreme Court denied his final appeal on March 28th. And so right now it's really a campaign for clemency. His fate will be in the hands of the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole, and they can do the right thing, which in this case would be to commute Troy's sentence and remove him from death row.
You know, one thing, Jen, that it's amazing. I mean, you think about this. How many execution dates has Troy had in the more than 23 years that he spent on death row, which in itself is really, you know, a life of torture? How many execution dates has he faced?
Troy's faced execution 3 times, which means his family has had to say goodbye to him 3 times and prepare to lose him 3 times. The execution date we're preparing for now is different than the other ones, though, in that there were still, in some of the other cases, there were still appeals that were being considered. There was still twists and turns in the legal process that kept his case inside the legal process. But as of March 28th, that phase of his case has really ended. So the date that we're expecting to be announced coming up, not to try to downplay the other execution dates, they were all extremely critical, and it got within 90 minutes in 2008 before a stay of his execution was ordered. He came within 90 minutes of execution in September 2008. But this is a new phase of his case, so to speak, with the date that we're looking at coming up.
Now, Laura, you know, as part of Amnesty International, especially the death penalty abolition campaign, you know, you look at this case and you look at something like what's going on with Troy Davis and the fact that there was virtually no physical evidence that linked him to this murder, that it was, as Jen pointed out, it was all eyewitness identification, no physical evidence, you know, and all of this stuff. It's like, you know, even the point about the shady nature of even the guy that actually one guy who was turned up to be a witness actually was the guy that's actually now one of the major suspects, at least by people who are looking at the case, not by the police, but by people who are looking at the case. Why is it that with no physical evidence, nothing that's really very strong, and even a court that says it's not an ironclad case, why is it that there's no legal alternative left to Troy and he's facing execution again?
Well, Amnesty International took up this case precisely because of all these factors that really raise serious alarm bells about our death penalty system in the United States and the insane kind of gamble that is being taken with human lives and the insanity of the legal process, which is so focused on procedure that it has been unable to deal with a very fundamental issue about whether, you know, you can still guarantee that Troy Davis is absolutely guilty and that there are no alternative possible explanations of what happened in the crime that occurred all those years ago. You know, we have a legal process that has really failed. Over 70% of cases, death penalty cases, get overturned due to serious error. And the number of death row exonerees is alarming. We have 138 individuals since 1973 who've been exonerated with evidence of their innocence. And these are people who, like Troy, come within very short time frames of execution, some of them exonerated with the help of, you know, journalism students, as in, was the case in Illinois, not because the system itself was trying diligently to ensure that no egregious errors were being made. And this, to us, just proves our point that the death penalty is a power that governments ought not to have. It is indeed a human rights violation that the rest of the world has been turning away from, country after country, and we are becoming more and more isolated. And it's really quite embarrassing that we still have the death penalty, and people around the world know about Troy Davis. They know about this case, and it doesn't speak well of our record as a country that says it believes in human rights.
We're talking with Laura Moyet, the director of Amnesty International USA's Death Penalty Abolition Campaign, and Jen Marlowe, a filmmaker, playwright, author, and human rights advocate, about the case of Troy Davis, an innocent man facing execution in the state of Georgia. Well, you know, Laura, one of the things that really got me is that there was an unprecedented, apparently, evidentiary hearing that was ordered by, I guess, the Supreme Court or something. And the idea that came, it was like you would think, given the situation in Troy's case where all but two of these eyewitnesses recanted their testimony. People have come up, you know, got one man appeared who said, you know, he was never even interviewed, and yet he's the man who Troy went to see after he realized that they were, you know, that they were looking for him and they were chasing him. He went to see him and hung out there and who convinced him to turn himself in and whatnot. And that all of these things and the really the stuff that's been talked about pointing to this other shooter as the person who actually killed the cop. All of this stuff, this evidence, you know, that was there, you would think that when you went found this evidentiary hearing that there would be something that would say, and even given that it's like, you know, that it's true, constitutional rights are more a matter of procedure and not a matter of accuracy. And when you go into, you know, in other words, it doesn't matter if you're innocent. It's all about the process. But you think about this, and we had Brandon Garrett on the show last week, and he was talking about, you know, he just wrote this book, Convicting the Innocent, about the 250 people that have been exonerated. And he made the point that in a case like Troy's, actually, where there's no ability to even rely on DNA to actually prove your innocence, that that there's very little you can do. And he pointed to the fact that that eyewitness identification is considered among the least reliable forms of evidence against someone because it's so subjective and so fleeting, you know, people's memory. So none of this is counted at all for Troy, huh?
Yeah, I mean, this is what is so insane about this case. It's also the standard to which Troy was held. You know, he was not, you know, considered innocent until proven guilty after he was convicted, you know, 20 years ago. He had the burden of proving his innocence, almost proving his innocence beyond a reasonable doubt. So the burden of proof and the weight of that burden is just really quite phenomenal. And so not having physical evidence, it really cuts both ways. To the layperson looking at the case, you would think, well, how can you allow somebody to be executed when you don't see the physical evidence linking him to this murder and his witness testimony has fallen apart? But, you know, it cuts both ways. They want to see the physical evidence and the proof that he is innocent. And how do you prove that you're innocent all those years later without any physical or scientific material to prove your case? So it's like the system is bent on preserving the jury's conviction all those years ago. But, you know, let's be fair to those jurors. If they had the opportunity to look at what we know today, we know, you know, one of the jurors has spoken out on CNN and said, you know, if I knew then what I know now, Troy Davis wouldn't be on death row. In fact, the verdict would be not guilty. So it's just, it's like we have a legal system that is not really focused on the right questions.
Once again, exactly, and the point that it doesn't matter if once you're convicted, it doesn't matter if you're innocent as long as the system is working. You know, Jen, tell me something. You have been involved in this case for a little while. What is it that brought you to this case with such passion? And I know you're passionate about it because you write to me about it. I read what you're doing. You've made videos. You've really been out there talking things up. You've become friends with Troy, personal friends with Troy and with his family. What is it in particular that grabbed you and made you want to take this up as a major part of your life?
Well, just one quick note before I answer that question. I just want to add one quick thing. What you're talking about, the unreliability of eyewitness testimony, and I just wanted to add one detail to that, which is that the Innocence Project has exonerated 273 people, and out of that group of people that they've exonerated, 75% of them had been wrongfully convicted exactly due to eyewitness testimony. So it really is just exactly what you were saying, the alarming rates of unreliability of eyewitness testimony is, you know, that's been highly documented. And what brought me to Troy's case is really Troy's sister, Martina, and I had seen Martina speak for the first time that I heard her speak was on Democracy Now, and it was in 2007. It was right after Troy had survived his first execution date. In summer of 2007, he came within 23 hours of execution before a stay was granted. And after that ordeal, I heard Martina speak on Democracy Now and heard her speak about Troy's case and her struggle. At that point, it had been for over 15 years, struggling to exonerate her brother and to get, you know, for years and years, she had been in many ways like a voice in the wilderness, talking about the recantations, the flimsy evidence used to convict her brother, talking to anyone who would listen. And fortunately, groups like Amnesty International, finding that, you know, they began to hear that and they began to put it together and they began to research his case and see that what Martina had been speaking about was exactly true, that the case against Troy had completely unraveled. And after I heard Martina speak on Democracy Now!, I started doing some internet research. And like so many other things that aren't being talked about in the mainstream media, the information's there if you know to go looking for it and you know to go digging for it. And fortunately, Amnesty had recently published their first report about Troy, and that was one of the first things I came up with when I was doing this research. And I eventually found an address for Troy in prison, and I wrote him a note, just a note of solidarity, because at that point I had spent several hours reading about his case. And he wrote back, and we began corresponding, and he eventually connected me to Martina and two other members of his family who I've gotten to know very well and have been working with over the past about 4 years, working to try to expose the injustices in Troy's case. And like Laura pointed out, the larger injustices that Troy's case illustrates, which is the injustice of the death penalty system.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with filmmaker Jen Marlowe and Laura Moye, the director of Amnesty International USA's Death Penalty Abolition Campaign, and we're talking about the case of Troy Davis and the possibility that he will be executed in the very near future. And in particular, in relation to Troy, I mean, Troy's a black man living in America, you know, and this is the situation. And there's a number of people made the point in Troy's case, it seems to be saying straight up, real loud, slapping your head with the whole concept of it doesn't matter who did it as long as he's black, you know. And there's a whole question. I mean, this thing of the preponderance of, I mean, when has anybody ever gone to court with all of the eyewitnesses saying, you know, or 7 out of 9 saying, oh, geez, no, we were forced by the police. We were coerced. We were, you know, shown, like, you know, shot, you know, fixed frame, you know, lineups and all this other stuff, photo arrays and all this. And person after person saying this, I do not believe he did it. I didn't see it. I couldn't identify him. I made a mistake and nothing happens, you know. And this is what it's amazing. Even the idea of, this is one thing that Brandon Garrett talked about too, which is the idea of that one of the biggest things in false identifications of people is the cross-racial identification. Except in this case, I think actually most of the witnesses were black, right?
Yes, that's true. I mean, I think that there was racially charged things going on in Savannah that has to do with Troy's case. There was a police officer who was killed. It was a white police officer killed by a young black man. So there was absolutely racially charged sentiments. But I think as much or more than that was things were very emotionally charged for the police in Savannah because one of their own had been killed. And so many of the best practices that we know about eyewitness identifications involve things such as double-blind identification, where if you're showing a photo lineups to a suspect, the police investigator leading that should not know who the suspect is, him or herself, so that even unconsciously you're not giving clues to the witness about who you think the right answer is. And of course, in a situation where a cop was gunned down, everyone in the Savannah Police Department knew who the suspect was. I mean, it was very emotionally heightened. In Troy's case, even before the witnesses were looking at photo spreadsheets, to ID a suspect, Troy's face had already been splattered all over the media. There had already been cop killer wanted posters with his photo on them all over Savannah. So even if we can assume that the police had the best of intentions of really wanting to get the right guy, the whole process was contaminated from the start.
All right, Jen, now, as you mentioned, that there's nothing left legally, except I imagine actually some Georgia board of something could give him clemency. But you mentioned there's no legal procedure that can be actually fought out. Now, what can people do?
Well, like you just mentioned, the clemency process is really a campaign for clemency right now. And clemency essentially is a word that means mercy. And in Georgia, there's the Board of Pardons and Parole, and it will be within their power to grant Troy clemency and to commute his sentence. And so the real effort right now is to make sure that the Georgia Board of Pardons and Parole know that there's people all over the world who are concerned, that there is overwhelming doubt in Troy's case, and send a message that when there is doubt, especially when there's doubt, an execution should not proceed. And there are petitions that people can find. Those petitions can be found on the Amnesty website, which is simply justicefortroy.org. For members of the clergy and for legal professionals, there are specific sign-on letters that they can sign. All these messages are basically telling exactly this to the board. There is doubt, and when there's doubt, an execution should not proceed.
All right, Jen, thank you very much. And we'll be in touch with you about this more in the future as things continue to develop. Jen, Laura, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. Talk to you again soon.
Wrongly accused, I'm talking about Troy Davis. Let me bring you the news on how the dirty DEA broke all the rules.
All right, we've been talking with Jen Marlowe, filmmaker, author, playwright, and human rights advocate, and Laura Moye, the death penalty abolition campaign director for Amnesty International USA, about the Troy Davis case and the fact that Troy Davis, a demonstrably innocent man who was convicted for killing a cop in 1989, he was convicted in the 1991 trial, is now facing the possibility of his fourth execution date with no legal recourse. And it's up to you to stand up and say something about this. Shout it out, all right? We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Jeff Charlotte about his new book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. So stay tuned.
I am all in a ball in your front yard. I have this bag of hammers, and I won't ask to come in. I have sold everything, still I have got some manners. And there's a hole in your head, spilled your thoughts on the floor. We wanted you bad, you wanted it more. The trick is, you do not get on that interstate bus. The catch is, you stay and see what becomes of us. Shake, 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 shake the frame of this house. Distress the wood, make it shout. Ha, ha, ha.
All right, welcome back. That's Tell When with Bag of Hammers. And I thought that was especially appropriate it captured a lot of what I felt like after reading Jeff Charlotte's new book, and we can talk with him about that in just a minute. Jeff Charlotte is a journalist and author, and he has a new book out called Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. And Jeff has been on this show a number of times before. He's the author of many books, including The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, and C Street, The Fundamentalist Threat to American Democracy. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you again.
Yeah, you too, man. So that song really just, the hole in the head, things pouring out, a bag of hammers, and shaking the foundation of the house and stressing the wood to make it shout, seemed to capture a lot of the ethos of your book, man.
Well, yeah, if I had a soundtrack for the book, I'd probably pick something from the title "Sweet Heaven When I Die" comes from an old song called "Country Blues." Give me corn whiskey and when I'm dry, and "Sweet Heaven When I Die." So I might have picked that, but you know that one gets at it too. And you know, you wander around the American landscape and you encounter all the varieties of religious belief, political belief, unbelief, and you encounter some strange things.
Well, you know, one of the things that really, and I don't know, maybe it's my read of it, but I really was struck, and it's partly because of how I'm looking at the world. I was really struck by this deep yearning and this searching for, you know, being up against a world that people don't really understand or have the ability or even think about. They try to rationalize it, but they're looking for some way that they can walk through the world while they're here. And I thought there's a couple of quotes in the book in the beginning that really got to me in terms of that. And it's when you took one in the opening chapter of your book, which actually I really liked, the one about your old friend Molly. And you have her saying, "God may reveal splendor in the mountains, but he's not kind." And then you say, well, I realized that what she was saying, what she meant was that you have to be wary of all in the mountains. If you're not, the sun will blind you. The wind will burn you. The midday moon will seduce you into staring at it for so long that you begin babbling. And then you had a second quote in another one of my favorite chapters in here with Cornel West, where he says, "It's all about witness, brother. Every person who bears witness has to have the depth of conviction of a martyr. You have to be willing to die. That's the statement allowing you to live." And he really talks about this idea of both of these things, I think, stepping into a void, not knowing where you're going, but knowing you have to do it. There's a point where epistemology meets morality.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and Cornel West, I spent about a year interviewing Cornel, just going down to Princeton and talking to him and reading all his books and so on, and trying to get beyond the kind of glib representations of Cornell you sometimes see in the press and say, here's this major theological and philosophical thinker and political thinker, and spend time with him. And what it's that void that is what you find there. You know, Cornell told me that ever since he was a little boy, he'd experienced what he called death shudders, you know, this awareness of mortality, this fear. And, you know, the question then becomes, what do you do with that? Do you deny the existence of death? Do you pretend it's not real? Do you hunker down in your suburb or hell, your city apartment, whatever it is? Or do you confront it? And if you confront it, do you do it like a fool, as in foolhardy and you know, absurdly brave? Or do you do it like I think Cornell does, like I think Molly does, a lot of the people in this book do, with a sense, being ready to die does not mean you want to die. It doesn't mean you want to be a martyr. It means that you recognize that it's a possibility, and that recognition, that's the first step in the kind of political imagination, the broad imagination we need, as he says, in order to live.
Now, Jeff, what gave rise to this book? Because you I mean, it's so broad in its reach, and I do think that there's a through line, you know, that we've been talking about, but it's so broad in its embrace in terms of in some ways, even when I was thinking again, I was thinking about, some songs and whatnot, and I kept looking for things that sounded like a carnival, because there's actually a carnival atmosphere. As serious as a lot of it is, there's a carnival atmosphere in terms of, it's almost like you've become sort of the ringmaster in a circus, and you're bringing all these acts into focus for people. And I just, what the hell got into you, man?
I really like that a lot, actually. My first book was called Killing the Buddha. Friend, the novelist Peter Manso, and I travel around the country doing sort of varieties of religious experience and all the varieties of belief and unbelief. And we do the interviews, and people were always looking for harmony. They say, you know, what's that unites us as Americans? And, you know, harmony is not a very democratic idea. What you hear if you put your ear to the ground is cacophony, you know, many songs, many voices at once. And that to me is a much more heartening sound. And I wrote these stories, you know, for 10 years I was immersed in American fundamentalism, the most sort of authoritarian worldview possible, to write my last two books, The Family and C Street. And these are the stories that I wrote to keep myself sane. So fundamentalism's coming at you all the time. Fundamentalism's big in harmony, saying there's just one song, one voice. You can either be a part of it, you know, convert or die, basically, is the ethos of that. And to keep myself sane, I'd have to go out to the margins. Sometimes the margins are in Princeton University with Cornel West. That's not very marginal, but of course he is a thinker who's constantly pushing. Sometimes it's the last Yiddish writer like Haven Rosenkranz. Sometimes it's up in the mountains and these sort of crazy folks who've retreated from the world up there. And those are the stories, these people sort of imagining a different way of being. that kept me sane. I think that's, you know, a lot of people read my books on fundamentalism. They come up to me at book events and they say, thank you so much for this book. It completely ruined my week. It was so depressing. And, you know, you got to go through that. But I also want, and this is, you know, I think you probably agree with me that this is not a cheery, peppy book. But it is, in a strange way, a hopeful one. And I think that is a work that you need to do. You need to go out and find these stories. You shouldn't sit there and wait for them to come to you. You've got to go out and find these stories, like Cornell's story, like the story of Brad Will, the anarchist martyr, who was a martyr, was ready to die and did die, but he didn't want to die.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that in a second, because that was one of my favorite stories, too. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Jeff Charlotte about his new book, which is Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. Now, Jeff, you know, there was one of my – I mean, I had so many favorites in this, and it was, you know, and literally, yeah, it's not a happy, peppy book. On the other hand, I sat down, I went through this book in a day, you know, and I really, including rereading some of it, you know, I was going over it again this morning, because it's just the depth of the inchoate sense of searching and yearning for something to pull the world together, coming from all these different angles in society, was just really gripping to me. And in that sense, there was hope, because it's true. I don't think you need, you know, look, harmony does not mean truth. And I think a lot of people actually misinterpret it as harmony. We all agree, so it's true. Well, that's really a bad scene.
Bad news, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, the truth is going to come out from tremendous contestation of ideas, you know, and that's one of the things I think your book actually presents, is there's a tremendous constant contestation in the characters that you present too, which I thought was really, really valuable in the book. Now, having said that, you know, let's talk about some of your favorites. And this the chapter you call Quebrado, which is about Brad Will, you know, that was very, to me, that was, came out of left field. I just didn't expect that, you know, and it was really an important chapter, I thought.
Yeah, and in a lot of ways, it actually, it's slightly different in tone. I'm kind of a character in a lot of these stories, and I end up at the very end a character in Brad's story in a very strange way. But this is, Brad Will was an anarchist activist for many, many years, and then became a journalist, and in 2006 traveled to Oaxaca to cover a teacher strike that had become an uprising against the very repressive and corrupt regime of Calderon down there, and was actually being quite a responsible journalist and doing some important work, and in the process of that, he was a video journalist. He videotaped his own murder by police. In fact, if you can see it on YouTube, though, you know, I don't know if I recommend that. You're going to see something horrible if you do. But if you know, the people who are sort of trying to get justice for him, if you slow it down slow enough, you can actually see the puff of smoke as the bullet leaves the muzzle, you know, just this puff of smoke. And I suppose if you could really slow it down, you might even see the bullet traveling. And then, bang, Brad falls down. And his death, he became this sort of martyr for a lot of people. And I wanted to, but I didn't want to understand, I was really more interested in the human being than the folk hero. And spent a lot of time. And I'd originally written a version of this piece for Rolling Stone, but what I wanted to come back to this and put some stuff in it that I hadn't gotten to write for them, and this is where I come into the story, actually, is going out to Brad's parents and rock-ribbed Republicans in the Midwest. And there's a cliche of American radicalism that's all about, you know, rich kids rebelling against their parents, and Brad was a rich kid. But he didn't rebel against his parents. He did this because he believed it. He had a great relationship with his parents for years and years and years. But in his death, they suddenly really learned. They saw things as he saw them for the first time. And I went out there and spent time with them as they've been trying to seek justice for him, for his memory. And they ended up putting me, I got snowed in. And they said, well, you can stay over here. And they put me in a bed. His mother kind of practically tucked me in a bed and says, you know, shutting off the lights. Says, this is Brad's bed. It was incredibly sad to me, but it was also sort of an important moment, I think, in thinking about the ways in which we connect. And you know, they don't want some journalist there. They want their son back. But they can't have that. They have a journalist to tell the story. And, you know, that to me is a sort of a thread. None of these stories are about things working out the way people want them to.
Right.
They're very much plan B, plan C, plan D stories, which is to say very human stories.
We're talking with writer Jeff Charlotte about his new book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between.
Well, here's a question. I mean, and this is both a comment and a question. I mean, there's this Ron Lucen battle cry. You know, that takes you back into your familiar territory, you know, but it's, I mean, still, no matter how many times you write about that and those people, there's something gripping in there. And I've been reading a lot that Bob Avakian's been writing about the attraction of this kind of absolutist fundamentalism, the attraction that that a lot of suburban and country youth have for this kind of fundamentalism, absolutist fundamentalism, in terms of especially going up against the empty, dehumanizing culture. And boy, if you spelled that out very powerfully in there, and including the one character that sort of is not so much there, but in the midst of it all, and she's still chewing on what's true, what's real, what the hell am I doing here? That was a really great piece, man.
You're talking about Valerie, young woman who was I assume you're talking about Valerie, the young woman who was sort of a student there,
but
a dissenter in a way as well. Yeah, Ron Luce's battle cry, this is the most militant fundamentalist youth movement in the country by far. I spent a lot of years covering fundamentalism. There is nothing else like this. Culmination of a rally is tearing a mannequin into pieces that's supposed to represent the sins of secularism and throwing them into the audience as, you know, 5,000 kids scream, tear up the concubine, tear up the concubine. Concubine in reference to a biblical story in which a concubine is sliced into 12 pieces and sent to the 12 tribes of Israel. This is militant stuff. But I went there and I spent time with them, and, you know, it's just what you said. You know, and there's a sense in which every story in this book is about people embodying what Cornel West, one of the subjects, says is the most essential human dignity, the ability to contradict what is. And that's what Ron Luce and Battle Cry are doing. They look at the dehumanizing effects of corporate culture, and they are correct. Their diagnosis is correct. It's their prescription that goes awry. But you see, I went down and spent time with these kids who are young people who are training to be, as they put it, frontline soldiers with them. And this young woman named Valerie took me to a hell house, sort of a haunted house for fundamentalists, where the frights are all secular things. And you see, you know, they believe that they need to have orthodoxy, but even so, their imagination asserts itself. And it's partly because they begin, as so many fundamentalists do, with saying, you know what, there is something wrong with this world. We should not just sort of accept things as they are. We should strive for something better. Now, I don't agree with what they strive for, but I do sympathize with that feeling, that sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have time for, I think, one more question here, and this is, I think, it depends on how much you get into this, but it's something that's really bugged me. Did you read, I think it's Neil Gabler, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his last name, the article, the op-ed piece he had in the New York Times a couple weeks back called The Elusive Big Idea?
I didn't. Tell me more about it.
Well, it's very interesting. He's saying, look, there's no more big ideas. There's no more big thinkers out there that, you know, we've become a society that's not only post-enlightenment, but post-idea, and that by post-enlightenment, we've abandoned rational thinking. By post-idea, we've actually abandoned the thinking process in general, and we're plagued with having so much information but very little ability to synthesize and analyze it and come up with what's true. And, you know, I have to say, I kept thinking about this, that the absence of big ideas today and the fact that if there was a Marx or a Nietzsche or a Darwin that came out and appeared today, and this is what Gabler says, he says, they probably wouldn't get recognized, wouldn't have space to speak. Their ideas would be just muffled and drowned in a sea of useless information. And he talks about how everything has changed in the society, you know, including most fundamentally on the college campuses with the monetization of everything, and where intellectuals today seem to be more worried about tending potted plants rather than planting forests, you know, which I thought was a very heavy thing. And then you have this chapter on Clear Channel, which I thought, oh, wow, this exactly speaks to that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It is the opposite of your radio show. This is the big, giant media monopoly, Clear Channel. When people used to talk in the 80s and 90s about media consolidation, they actually could not imagine a company as big as Clear Channel. I guarantee if you're out there listening to this, you have heard Clear Channel. You have attended. You may have gone to your super cool indie rock, hipster, completely independent shows. It was probably Clear Channel. There's been some other companies now that have sort of merged with them, but they're the model. And, yeah, you know, and I'll disagree with you in one sense. The big idea isn't gone. It's just a big bad idea. The big idea is Clear Channel, and it's a bad idea. It's an idea that crushes other ideas. It suppresses other ideas. But, you know, the same thing I did with Clear Channel in this book, I did the same thing I did with fundamentalism. I was going to write about Clear Channel. I wanted to go around and just talk to the people within the company, people who do love music, who care about music, who've made their lives around music, and are trying to get by. So there's a hero of the story, an independent promoter who's little David fighting the Goliath of Clear Channel. And then there's another guy who's more complicated. You might call him a sellout. He's like the hippest indie rock promoter in Philadelphia. Most of his, when I first wrote about this, everyone got angry at me and said, he doesn't work for Clear Channel. I said, did you notice the email address? It says dilworth@clearchannel.com. That was your tip off there. He does work for Clear Channel. But even so, you know, he was within the Borg, but not subsumed by the Borg, you know, if I can even start to get here. And I think am in agreement with you about that point about the big idea, but I think there's more stuff going on out there. There's certainly, I think, in the sort of the liberal elite class, a kind of disdain for big ideas and, you know, as if moderation is always the highest virtue. Ideas don't work like that. Ideas got to push out a little further ahead. And they might not be entirely right, but that's what they've got to do. But those are out there, and that's sort of what this book, Sweet Heaven When I Die, is in some ways about, is going out and seeing these people with political imagination, people who are living out big ideas, maybe not being listened to. They're not launching revolutions like Marx, but you take someone like Cornel West, there are some big ideas there.
Absolutely.
And, we just got to listen.
Absolutely. All right, Jeff, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And thanks for the book, man. It was really great. And stay in touch. You know, it's really...
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mike.
Sure. The book is Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. And it's by Jeff Charlotte. And it is published by Norton.
W. Norton. Available everywhere.
There you go. Everywhere. Get it. Pick it up.
It's really independent.
There you go. All right, Jeff. Thanks a lot, man. Talk to you again soon. I hope. Take care.
Bye.
All right, you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Jeff Charlotte, the author of Sweet Heaven When I Die, Faith, Faithlessness, and the Country in Between. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank Larry Everest, Jen Marlowe, and Laura Moyer talking about the Troy Davis case. And remember, do what you can around Troy Davis. Extremely important. I also want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. And I want to read this quote to you from Bob Avakian and his new book, Basics. It is necessary to be boldly saying to people, we don't need the church, we don't need the switch, we don't need the rod, and no, we don't need the gangs and the drugs. We need revolution. You want to write to me, you can, at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we're going out now with Break the Chain from Lupe Fiasco, so listen up.
I waited all my life to play, but I still can't find a way. But if I work it one more day, I might just break the chain. Especially where we from, where we grew up, like a green thumb, like a criminal, the only thing you could become. Look at what I became, something like a phenom, nothing but a G-thang. Things I've seen when I'm looking out of these frames, pictures I painted on the walls where we hang. From the trees we hung, strange fruit man, look at how we swung. How the hell you gonna tell a son who ain't have a father how to try to grow up and be one? Feel it in my bones and I'm sitting on the throne like a killer with the chrome. When I'm spitting out the poem, shed a whole lot of light on a little bit of home. Bam.
Thought I was M.I.A. No paper planes. I'm fly, plus I don't write no more. But sort of from the top, I shaved the brain to stay sharp. Man, I knew how to raise a blade. I paid my dues, now I wait for change. Look at the flow so rude, it goes without Snoopy. I'm Souple, I ain't the break. Quick to cut off any baggage like some samurai. I like to travel light. I'm gonna leave you at home, Delilah. This is Samsonite. No case for the police, and no killers, I never seen them. Those face on the time I'm watching is my panorama. I'm gonna alibi, I must take a pic of Chicago. Call me camera shy.